Hello, listeners. We have a great episode this month filled with exciting stories from a special agent who is experienced in cyber criminal activity within the United States financial system. But before we do that, I want to give a very special thank you and shout out to the editor of this episode, Star Fazquez. I don't believe I mentioned my background before on this show, but I am a Maryland National Guardsman. I was called to active duty back in September to assist with the North Carolina National Guard's hurricane relief efforts. Star stepped up when I was absent and took lead editing the episode. Star, thank you. Now, for October's episode, we're talking to Special Agent Matt O'Neill, who leads the Global Investigative Operations Center within the Secret Service. The JIOC conducts analysis of non-traditional data sources to coordinate agency operations in order to disrupt and dismantle illicit activities and criminal networks. The JIOC also prioritizes high-impact investigations that affect the integrity of the U.S. financial system, with specific emphasis on targeting large-scale domestic and international criminal organizations. Matt does a great job providing an excellent overview of the JIOC, as he provides some stories of his time as an agent and also talks about what it's like to be a legacy special agent in the Secret Service. Matt, welcome to the show. I'm excited to have you on. I've been waiting a long time for you to come speak on Standing Post regarding what you do and what you do for the organization. Would you kindly introduce yourself and to the listeners?
Sure. My name is Matt O'Neill. I've been with the Secret Service as a special agent for nearly 20 years. Currently, I manage our Global Investigative Operations Center, or JIOC, where we take a look at all of the most significant transnational, multi-jurisdictional criminal investigations and try to help our field.
Matt, the Global Investigative Operations Center didn't always exist. Can you explain to the listeners about it and what its function is for the organization?
Sure. The Global Investigative Operations Center is about a year old. And what our goal and objective is to try to narrow the gaps in between offices and agencies. It's long been known that bad guys can operate in the gaps. And when I say that, I mean in between jurisdictions. One of the first cases I ever worked was out of New Haven, Connecticut, where a guy who had been arrested over 100 times in the state of Connecticut. And when I saw his rap sheet, it surprised me. And I started talking to the detectives that I was friendly with. And they said, well, the problem is if he gets arrested in this town, it's a small larceny. In this town, it's a small larceny. And we had no way of really knowing and working together in order to bring larger cases against this bad guy. And it's the same problem now where you have these transient groups that operate across borders. So in the old days, if an office, say, New York was working a case, Boston might not really know what New York is doing. And if the bad guys are traveling up and down 95, then there's a good chance that the entire picture of what they're doing is not going to be identified. So what our goal and our hope and our dream is to identify those gaps where we can make larger cases. Larger cases means better prosecutions, longer prison sentences, and better deterrent for the bad guys.
So can you go into a little more about that partnership with the local areas with that? Because you're saying that you're connecting the dots with these areas, regions within the Secret Service. Can you kind of discuss those partnerships and how, by working with the fellow law enforcement organizations within a certain area, how you can be able to connect those dots?
Sure. Well, we have an outstanding team of analysts here in our headquarters and around the country. And what our goal is to have them provide us intelligence where we have specific individuals who are subject matter experts in this case type of fraud. So whether it's a business email compromise or a network intrusion or investment fraud or whatever the case may be, we have an individual or group of individuals who are looking at the intelligence across the entire agency's investigative portfolio to look for the links that might not had in the ordinary course of business been located without them specifically looking for those connections.
And you continue to connect these dots and going through that. Are there any other examples? Because I've heard in the news and I've seen through the organization that these terms called like ATM jackpotting and business email account scams that take place, is that a part of your portfolio? Is those other things that you look at within the JIOC?
Yes. So the ATM jackpotting is a good example of why having a central sort of fusion center is important. So back about a year ago, jackpotting, which is when a bad guy gains physical access to an ATM, takes control of the ATM by taking over its computer, if you will, inside, and then taking all the money out. They call it jackpotting because the money comes out at, a very rapid rate. we got some intelligence from one of our offices that there was going to be a rash of jackpotting, specifically targeting one type of ATM. And they even had enough specifics on the type of people that were going to be engaged in this activity. No names, but hey, this general group are going to be targeting these ATMs. So be on the lookout. And it provided malware and that sort of thing. So what we did is we created an intel alert that we kicked out to all of our offices and all of our electronic crimes task force partners. And we have dozens of electronic crimes task forces around the globe. And what their mission is to create a partnership between federal law enforcement, local law enforcement, and then partners in the private sector, academia, financial institutions, and as a means of a rapid way to communicate actionable intelligence. And that's really what our goal is always, to provide something actionable. Instead of just saying, hey, we think this is going to happen, good luck to you, we want to provide specific pieces of data that will help our partners, whether it's a bank or whether it's another just regular merchant, protect themselves. So in this instance, we had this information and we put it out on an intel alert. Well, within 24 hours, one of our partners, banks in New England, saw our alert, was monitoring for it, and an attack started, and they called the local police department, who made some arrests. Our field office in New Haven responded, got some intel from the bad guys that got arrested, and we were able to continue to enhance our knowledge of what this group is. As it turns out, the alert also linked us up with other federal law enforcement agencies like the FBI and HSI, who had also been working ATM jackpotting cases. And we all worked together in a really unique way from my perspective, because I hadn't seen it before, partly because we probably hadn't had a fusion center like us in the Secret Service, but we had daily conversations with all of the other partners from state and local federal law enforcement. The communication flow was tremendous. It was a real true collaborative investigation. So within a few months, about 17 arrests were made across the country, and we essentially stopped a threat that was much larger than we had even realized. So there had been 126 approximately attacks in the United States since May of 2017. And when we got involved in late January, it took about 2 months, but we wrapped up a number of the different bad guys in this group. And by late March, the threat had stopped, at least temporarily. We haven't seen it since. We're not saying that, hey, it's, you know, job well done, success, and we're over. Because as you know, in criminal investigations, there is no finish line. There's just going to be more bad guys coming. And that's part of the allure of working cases, is what's the new threat, what's the new challenge, and how do we stop it?
So working in the JIAC and you're seeing these different crimes take place over these different jurisdictions, have you ever presented information to people that just weren't aware, like law enforcement organizations, to where you kind of just called them up and said, hey, you know, we've been tracking this going on. Have you seen this? Have you looked at it? Is this something that you'd like to have? And, you know, do you have any stories behind that or anything that goes along those lines?
Sure. That's a routine part of our business, not only in the JIOC, but even when I was working hacking cases where bad guys from around the globe would hack into local merchants and we'd get the information. Part of the job was to call the victim merchants and let them know that we believe that they've been compromised. In the same way, in the JIOC, if we believe that somebody is a victim of a romance scam or a business email compromise.
A romance scam?
A romance scam is where someone meets online, engages in a relationship with someone, thinking that they're in a romantic relationship, but the reality is that the person is probably in another continent and is essentially creating this relationship to scam them. And now it could be to take their money. It could be to make them what we call a money mule, which is somebody who will accept money from some third party and then wire it to their date. They're being cultivated. Just as a matter of fact, earlier today, I was talking to a victim who lost a sizable amount of money in a romance scam where the person groomed them over a period of time to develop that rapport and that relationship. And then at the right time, they said, hey, how would you like to make this investment? It's a can't lose deal. You're going to, if you send me X amount of money, you're going to make 15-20%. It'll be a quick turnaround. The person does, they send the money, and of course, the person vanishes. Very common scheme, which is problematic for a variety of reasons. One, it's the actual victim who loses the money. It's not some large corporation. So this is people's life savings. Two, it targets the most vulnerable people that we have. We make it a point to try to help those victims recover their funds if we can. We have a very robust asset forfeiture branch and program nationwide. We're very proud of the fact that majority of the money that we seize is returned to victims. So we try to work cases that have a large community impact where it directly affects people's lives. And business email compromise, where a bad guy will convince a business or a person to send large amounts of money by pretending to be either the CEO of the company or someone who's engaged in business with them. It could be an invoice or something like that. And that money is gone very quickly. So we work around the clock with our partners at FinCEN and other federal agencies and around the globe in order to try to recoup that money as quick as we can, because we know after 24 hours, the money is probably gone and you're not going to get it back.
Does the Nigerian prince story that people receive in their email, is that kind of fall into that category too?
Yeah, that is a variation. We've been working those kind of cases, you know, forever. We used to call them 419 advanced fee fraud schemes. Now business email compromises are sort of the next generation, where you don't really have to create this fictitious world of someone who is a prince who has millions of dollars, and if all you have to do is pay a fee. When I can convince somebody in your company to send me $500,000 because your company didn't establish dual controls, meaning multiple people have to approve a wire transfer, and you didn't have the basic sort of training towards your employees that this scam exists. Every week, we see north of $1 million leave this country in business email compromises.
So when I talk to you about coming onto the show and talking to the listeners about cybercrime fraud, you brought up an interesting story about synthetic identity fraud. Do you mind talking a little bit more about that?
Sure. Synthetic identity fraud is where a bad guy will create out of thin air generally an identity. And when I mean generally, I mean they could create a totally fictitious social security number and date of birth and name and address, and then over time build up a credit profile. Or what they could do is take somebody who is either deceased or alive. A lot of times they target children, the elderly, and the incarcerated in order to take their social security numbers, because they know that they're probably not active in the stream of commerce. So they take over those identities and over a period of time establish a profile. And how they do that is they'll apply for a line of credit somewhere. It'll get declined because it doesn't exist. But a credit profile is created. And after that, they will then link up this fake identity with a real account. If you link it up with a seasoned trade line, which is an account that had been created, you know, many years ago, legitimately, you have a good credit score, high available balance. If you link up the synthetic identity with one of those seasoned trade lines, then automatically that credit score goes up. And if you do that over a period of time, then you've, over about a 2-year period, you can create from a synthetic identity to a true 750, 800 credit score fake identity, and then you could bust it out for a few $100,000 easily. And it is hard for a lot of financial institutions to detect because sometimes it's written off as collections because they don't know the person doesn't even exist. So we try to educate our offices, our agents, and our partners on how to look for these type of cases. Sometimes we've done search warrants where we've gone into a house and we'll find 30 or 40 shoeboxes. Of each shoebox contained a synthetic identity that they were seasoning in order to bust out. Sometimes it's to buy vehicles and then ship them overseas. Other way to launder the identity would be through lines of credit that they establish, like a credit card, bust it out, buy stuff, and then just fence it. It is a concern that we have because it is a problem for our financial institutions. We as the Secret Service pride ourselves in trying to protect the nation's financial infrastructure. And if you have large-scale groups that are taking advantage of, as I mentioned before, the gaps in the system, which synthetic identity fraud can fall into that because the people don't exist, they can change addresses, all of those type of things, then we try to do our part by notifying offices, getting them connected. Just a few weeks ago, our office in New York was working the same type of fraud against with someone in our office in Providence. Same target group, same network. And so we were able to link them up, and it turns out it's in multiple other offices. Because again, bad guys in the 21st century are transient. So they're not, as a general rule, staying put. And that could be whether it's the guys who are installing gas pump skimmers, or the guys that are installing ATM skimmers, or folks who are taking advantage of synthetic identities or any of the other sort of lines of business that we investigate, for the most part, they operate fairly well-organized group of individuals. So what we try to do is identify the network of them, provide that, identify where we don't know what we don't know by sending out requests for information from our field offices and try to fill in those gaps. Not just target the bad guys that we know, but, hey, who are they communicating with? And that, a lot of times that's working with other federal law enforcement agencies. When I was in New Hampshire, I spent 10 years in our office in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I would work just about every case with a really good agent from the FBI and a really good postal inspector. And between the three of us, we could knock down a lot of threats because we had fairly large database sets that we could ping off of. We each had our own unique skill sets. And I really learned that that is the way that we can really go after these groups is a team approach.
But you also work with the Electronic Crimes Task Force that we have located around the United States. Can you go in a little bit about that too, with what their functions are and how you work with them?
Our Electronic Crimes Task Forces play a real critical role in our overall strategy of combating transnational, multi-jurisdictional organized crime. They have computer forensic examiners. They have examiners who can look at mobile devices to exploit that data so we can build out our networks, but also to find the incriminating evidence to put people in jail. We also work with our task force officers in the electronic crimes task forces, and a lot of them had been trained at the National Computer Forensic Institute down in Hoover, Alabama, where we provide a lot of really good training to the local police officers, and then they'll come back to their police departments and have the skills to be a computer forensic examiner. And they work with our electronic crimes task forces as sort of a force multiplier. Again, that's critical because we recognize that we one agency can't combat transnational organized crime by themselves. But working more collectively with our federal partners, our state partners, our local partners, we can at least give them a run for their money.
We also have agents around the world to track these frauds and scams. Is that true?
Yes. And so that is also a critical component because a lot of the bad guys that we are targeting are not located in our borders. Having that interpersonal relationship with the local law enforcement in those countries is invaluable. So our foreign offices play a critical role in many of our investigations because a lot of the bad actors are located overseas. So their liaison with their local counterparts in their countries goes a long way because what we are able to do is in these fast-paced crimes like a hacking case or some sort of account data compromise, network intrusion, we have to move as quickly as we can. So us being a small agency, one of the valuable things is we can call up these offices and we know them personally. And they, because of that sort of interpersonal relationship that we all have, we're able to move a lot faster than other much larger bureaucratic agencies because of that interpersonal relationship. One example is a case that I worked a few years ago where we had three bad guys in Romania that were hacking into hundreds and hundreds of victim merchants. When I was able to get the intel on IP addresses and any other selectors on our bad guys, I was able to call over to our office in Bucharest, who the people who were stationed over there, I had known for many years. I was on the vice president's detail with them. I knew their families. They knew my families. It's a much quicker way of getting them to act. And as a result, when I call them at 8:30 at night and said, hey, I believe that I have this lead, you know, they're much more willing to go out on it because they know who the person is on the other end of the phone call. And they also, because of our integrated mission, have a unique relationship a lot of times with the other their host country because we have protection visits in those countries. So they don't see them necessarily as just these guys who are here targeting our citizens working criminal cases, but they recognize our integrated mission. So that puts us in a really good posture with a lot of the foreign countries that we deal with on a regular basis.
Matt, the way that you're describing the environment, it seems like a pretty scary place out there for our personal identifiable information. For the listeners, is there anything that they can do to help kind of, not necessarily stop it, or if you can, talk about it, if they can stop it, but what are some of the things that they can do to help prevent fraud or being a subject of any of these stories that you've talked about?
One of the things that I always tell folks is to just assume every credit card in your wallet is compromised. It's just a matter of time before somebody uses it. So pay attention to your credit, your statements and your account balances and all that sort of thing. that's your credit card, debit card information. Just having some awareness as to what's being spent, and that's pretty much all you can really do, because you don't know if it, most of the time it's the merchant that would probably be compromised. So, and you don't know, there's no sign on the wall that says, hey, this point of sale terminal has malware in it. So you just have to operate with the understanding that it's probably compromised at some point or another. Banks are doing a much better job of identifying potential common points of purchase, which means locations that are probably compromised and having the credit card stolen. So as for me personally, I don't worry very much about my credit card being used, because at the end of the day, you have no liability as long as you've reported the fraud at a reasonable time. And the worst part about it is you get a new card, then you have to tell all the people that you have recurring payments to. But aside from that, on a scale of 1 to 10, that's it's sort of a minor inconvenience. As far as personally identifiable information, it is without a shadow of a doubt that all of our personal information is available online for sale for pennies. So I worked a case a few years ago where a Vietnamese national named Huy Minh Noh had a website, and the website sold 200 million Americans' personally identifiable information in a searchable format. So I could type in Matthew O'Neill, Massachusetts, and buy the date of birth, social security number, address, and previous address of every Matthew O'Neill in Massachusetts. That is scary, because that information can be monetized very quickly, and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, much to some people's disappointment, you can't get a new date of birth, and you're not going to get a new social security number generally. So you have to have the posture and the understanding that your information is available. You know, people talk about the dark web and, oh my gosh, my information's on the dark web. Almost without exception, the information that's available on the dark web is available on the clear web. I could go on my phone. You could go on your phone right now, go to a website that's in the clear, and buy anybody in America's date of birth, social security number, address, previous address, whatever you want. How to mitigate that threat is, as a general rule, I always suggest consider freezing your credit. Freezing your credit prohibits someone from establishing a new line of credit in your name without you knowing about it. Because if they stole your information and then went to a retailer and tried to establish a line of credit, it will get declined because your credit's frozen. Nobody's going to ever give you a line of credit if they don't know what your credit score is. And so that is a good first step. The other steps are to, on an annual basis, get your free credit reports. Because we arrested a guy one time who had thousands of credit reports in his email account. And when I interviewed him and said, how did you get all of these? He said, well, as a general rule, I would be able to get your credit report 99% of the time, because I knew the questions that they were going to ask. Those are called knowledge-based authentication questions or challenge questions, KBA, out-of-wallet questions. They call them all different things. But they are questions that Americans have this high degree of self-disclosure. We always tell everybody, take pictures of what we had for breakfast and all this other stuff, right, where we just constantly tell everybody everything. Well, bad guys are aware of that. If questions are like, what's your dog's name, or where'd you go to school, or what's your mother's maiden name, which, again, I could buy for pennies anyway, but all of that information, they can go through social media accounts. They can go through publicly available commercial databases and develop a sort of a dossier on you. Part of that is to get your free credit report. So step one is freeze your credit. Step two is get those free credit reports, because the guy who had thousands of them said, the only time I wasn't able to get your credit report is if you had already done it yourself, because I'm not paying for it, because there's so many other people who haven't gotten it. I'm just going to move on to somebody else. If you take those two steps, with the understanding that it doesn't prevent people from taking over your existing lines of credit. So you have to monitor your existing lines of credit as you ordinarily would. And it doesn't prevent non-financially motivated identity theft, but that's not really a primary concern.
You're saying basically the way that you set up your online profile or your presence on the internet, you almost want to become not willing to give the information or to try to bar some information so it deters them to not consider you an easy target?
Yeah, please set it to private. Okay. Set it to private. Nobody cares what you had for dinner. Right. If they don't know you, they don't care what color car you have, like all of those things that people always constantly post, like, hey, I'm on vacation for the week. Well, thank you very much. Now you've just posted to the world that you are away. Have some level of situational awareness as what you're telling the world, and understanding that bad guys are actively looking for that stuff. The other thing that I suggest people do is there was a presentation I went to on passwords. And it's a really important piece of information that I think everybody should at least consider. And it is this. You know, I have teenage kids who have active social media lives, more active than I'd like, but that's just the nature of the world in 2018. And also, you know, parents and grandparents and who are active online, whether it's email accounts or Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, you name it. And so what was recommended by an expert in passwords was to have an agreement with your family to provide those passwords. Put it in a book. Wrap up the book, put it in the back of your freezer so everybody can see it. Because if something ever happens to you, the length of time it will take for someone to be able to contact law enforcement, have law enforcement reach out to the social media or website or email provider, and to be able to get the content of the data is literally the difference between life and death in a lot of times. So if you have this agreement, and you know, with kids, it might be hard because they might think that you're trying to spy on them or that you're trying to use this information for whatever reason as a parent. But it really is something that you could do. And I recommend you do it with your parents or whoever, because you're going to want to find out who they've been communicating with. Where have they gone, right? Right. Even bank account information, logins to that. Put that somewhere. I said put it in the back of the freezer. Yeah, bad guys don't listen to that. That's not where people should put it. But put it somewhere where your kids have a level of trust that you're not going to, in their eyes, misuse it. But it literally could be and has been the difference between life and death on a number of times. And it's something that people generally don't think about.
No, that's very good tips. That's actually something I may start considering, at least with my family, too. Because, again, as I continue my journey through the Secret Service, there's all this information that's out there that we're trying to provide through at least this, the podcast, and a lot of our social media platforms. And so that's the reason why we brought you in, just to kind of have this conversation. And I appreciate that. The one of the things I wanted to also bring up too, and when I had talked to you about coming onto the show, was the honeypot story. Would you mind going a little bit about in that?
Sure. I was working a case in Manchester, New Hampshire, where it was a local restaurant that had been compromised. And through the course of the investigation, we determined that it was three individuals located in Romania. At the time, there hadn't been any extradition from Romania to the United States since, I believe, World War II. And I had a great prosecutorial team from the U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of New Hampshire that is second to none, and also the Department of Justice Computer Crimes and Intellectual Property Section, or CSIPs. We had really good prosecutors. And so we built an extremely strong case against these bad guys. But the problem was they were located in Romania. We traveled to Romania. We worked with our partners there. We created what we'll call a collaborative investigation, where we provided intel to them. They provided information to us through our field office in Bucharest. There's always an option to lure people. Luring requires approval from the ambassador level of the host country where you're trying to lure somebody from. It requires approvals from our headquarters or requires approval from the Department of Justice, Office of International Affairs. You don't want to do something that would be embarrassing if it was on the front page of a national newspaper. So you have to create a lure. But one of the things that came to us is when you work these investigations and you identify people, part of the process is you learn a lot about them. You learn what their vices are. You learn what any vulnerabilities they might have, and you try to take advantage of those vulnerabilities. And so in this case, we had three guys over there. Two of them had very active social media presences. A lot of times with these cyber type cases, once you get the attribution, it's basically hopping from search warrants to email accounts, search warrant to email accounts to collect evidence, and then also attribution. Attribution in a cyber investigation is always critical. In doing so, you learn a lot about them. And one of the guys that we charged was a guy who worked at his day job was at a major tire manufacturer. He had a master's degree, I believe, in robotics, but he was hacking into businesses, stealing thousands and thousands of payment cards, all of the time. That was how he was supporting himself. One of the problems that you have in Eastern Europe and some other places where you have very good technical schools, so you have smart people, you have a young population, but the jobs don't pay very well. And so it's easy to go to a life of crime where the chances of getting caught are relatively low, right? There was a somebody said one time, like, before you take us cybersecurity professionals so seriously, understand we're the Chicago Cubs. We're the losing team, right? Can't say that anymore because the Cubs are good. But the reality is we don't catch a lot of them because if they stay in their home base in their home country, it's harder to catch them, especially if it's a nation that isn't as cooperative with the United States when it comes to working cooperative investigations. And so with this guy, you could see that he was spent all of his time, if he wasn't hacking online, doing online poker and chatting with girls. I stayed up all night chatting with this guy, creating a persona, backstopping a persona with a large casino in the United States. And basically the pitch was, hey, why don't you come to be part of this tournament because we know you're engaged in all of this other online poker. Now, you could provide account information. You could provide all of this other information that would lead this person to believe over a period of time that he's actually dealing with a legitimate casino. The casino was cooperative in providing, you know, the fictitious persona on their employee directory and with an email account and with a phone number and all this other things. I created this persona. I had a female agent following along because if the person ever wanted to talk on the phone, I don't have a very good girl voice, so that would probably not go over all that well. So I had to try to make sure that we had that covered. He was very good at writing in English, but he wasn't great in talking. But he did call. He called the casino. He called the phone number just to make sure. And so over a lengthy period of time, I don't want to make this seem like it was a Friday and on Monday he was on a flight. I mean, you're talking over months and months of just chatting with these guys online. We developed what I'll call a quasi-romantic relationship. In the sense that he thought we were in a romantic relationship. He came to the United States to participate in this tournament. You know, we met him at the airport. I had to explain to him, hey, I'm this girl. He wasn't all that happy with that. You know, he thought he was coming for a good time and meeting his girlfriend. He almost didn't bring anything except some cigarettes and some other things that you would bring if you were meeting a girl, right? So I'll leave it at that. But the value in lures, it defeats what one of the prosecutors that I work with a lot calls the SOTY defense, some other dude did it. Because in almost every cyber case, when you've charged somebody and they go to trial, what do you say when you have nothing to say? Was it me? I didn't do it. Were you in my house? Did you see on my computer? Right. That's always a defense. But when I get you to travel 4,000 miles based on the online persona that you have, you don't have that defense anymore. We lured this guy over and he cooperated immediately. And while at the same time, he was a hacker and he was working with this other guy who didn't really have an online persona, so he was hard to communicate with. But this other guy, who he was selling a lot of the payment cards to, did have an online persona. And this guy was right out of Central Casting, if you think of, you know, Eastern European mobster. Tall, black leather jacket, black tight jeans, black tight t-shirt, like a boyish medium type. He wore dark glasses, but he was the personification of what you would think that a Eastern European cyber criminal would be. You know, in reality, that's not, he was sort of the outlier. So one night after talking with prosecutors and a way to try to communicate with this person, I reached out to him and said, hey, you know, I don't know if you remember me, but I met you at this casino in Europe. And at first he kind of blew me off. So he blew me off. So I sent him a few pictures of, you know, young, not me, that wouldn't lure anybody anywhere, of a, you know, attractive female. And so he then all of a sudden said, oh yeah, kind of do remember you. And I peppered him with, hey, well, you should remember me. You told me your mom was in this country and you sold this car. And I can't believe you don't remember me. I was backpacking through Europe with my girlfriends at the time. We hit it off. And so over a period of time, he, whether he believed it or not, I think he believed it. He was also into some mood-altering drugs as well. We developed, again, a relationship. So I was dating two Romanian men at the same time, which is hard to keep track of who you're talking to, especially at 3 in the morning when you have a three-week-old son that you're trying to feed and chat with these guys, because the second guy was very graphic. The first guy was a gentleman. He was actually a really polite kid. I had to keep track because if I said the wrong thing to the wrong guy, he would say, whoa, wait, this is out of left field, or hey, you're really boring. And so you had to keep that level of understanding and have these dual tracks going in your head.
Almost like a synthetic identification. You had your own boxes there set up.
Yes.
And dual personas.
This was a catfishing, just straight out of the textbooks.
Well, I was going to ask you about that was, do you find yourself reusing or using the tactics that these criminals are using to kind of turn the tables on them. Do you watch the environment, how these bad actors act, and then you're just like, okay, you know what? This is actually good, but we're going to use it for good.
Sure, because it works.
Okay.
And so human nature is one where you want to believe something if it is in your best interest, so you try to take advantage of that. You're not entrapping anybody. First of all, they're not committing a crime. They're traveling. Second of all, they're voluntarily traveling. So it really is to get them to travel, to defeat that SOTI defense, as I mentioned earlier. And it's also to collect incriminating evidence once they arrive. It's if you have a place where there's no extradition, you have to then be able to work around that. So it's either wait for them to travel somewhere or try to affirmatively move them in the direction of where you can grab them. The second guy, when he arrived, he was not happy with me. He was ticked off. As a matter of fact, we brought him in. We had a really good agent who speaks Romanian. His English was fine, but just in case, you know, belt and suspenders approach to everything. You want to make sure that there's later down the line, they said, hey, well, this guy, you know, all of a sudden he doesn't speak English anymore. So we had Romanian translators. We had Romanian Miranda warnings. We had all of this other stuff just to make sure that we were doing everything by the book. He was very dismissive. Yeah, that was me. But Chrissy's waiting for me. Like, no, what? He says, yeah, Chrissy's waiting for me. I said, yeah, I'm Chrissy. And he laughs. He says, oh, you're not Chrissy. I go, no, I'm Chrissy. And I had to show him my computer to go, hey, dum-dum, this was me.
Oh, wow.
And so he wasn't happy. But when you treat somebody respectfully, over time, they understand that. And we were, and he cooperated because he didn't realize the sort of level. He thought he was coming to meet an independently wealthy Hooters waitress is who he thought he was coming to meet.
Oh, wow.
So imagine his shock when, in fact, it was me. That sort of catches them off guard as well. And so in this instance, he cooperated. And as a matter of fact, he's out of jail, and he still reaches out knowing who I am to just chat, because I treated him and the agents that arrested him treated him well along the process, and he knew he was a bad guy, so he knew he just got caught. And so sometimes people, you know, over time recognize that fact, and now he's on the straight and narrow, and well, at least he says he is. I don't know, but it's just an interesting story. Over time, you can find something against just about anybody. So you obviously have to be on your guard, and that's how bad guys operate, and that's how they take advantage of romance scams or whatnot. I don't know the exact numbers, but when I was in worked with a U.S. Attorney's Office in the District of New Hampshire, we lured, I'd say, probably close to a dozen people over a few-year period, different things. The Vietnamese national that I told you about that we worked a case, we lured him to Guam. But he wasn't interested in girls. This guy was selling Americans' personally identifiable information, you know, million-plus dollars, living with his parents in Ho Chi Minh City. Obviously, that was a very good life. And once we identified the source of the compromise and we were able to shut it down, we worked on a fairly intricate lure that took place in, you know, multiple continents, as a matter of fact, using cooperators, using other technical means to get him to believe that if he met somebody in Guam, that he would be able to continue selling unfettered access to every American's PII. And that took about 4 or 5 months as well to put together. But again, once he came, and this guy was a veteran of the hacking game, who was stealing payment cards, he was stealing PII, hacking in and stealing PII, then he realized he could social engineer his way into a business and then just get unfettered access as long as he was paying for it. Over a period of time, once we were able to continually shut down his access, he went to Guam. Interestingly, he also immediately confessed, because what do you say when you got nothing to say, right? I mean, I'm here. I can't say it's not me. What happened was, after we arrested him, I took on his online persona for a couple years, identifying, hey, who are the bad guys? Who can we get our hands on, right? Because these are bad guys who are engaged in straight identity theft. They were doing one of two things, either identity theft from financial institutions, so creating new accounts, doing account takeovers, or doing tax return fraud, which is also a common problem that we deal with, and we work really well with our partners in the IRS and other federal law enforcement agencies to try to combat the called stolen identity refund fraud. He had about 1,300 customers all throughout the globe, and some of them were buying huge amounts of PII. my conversations with them, they trusted this guy because he had been selling them PII for many years. He was the number one seller of PII, personally identifiable information. When I took over his identity, I would ask them directly, hey, what are you using this for? Because if you're using it for taxes, I'm going to cut you a deal and it's going to be this. If you're using it for identity theft, I'll cut you a deal and whatever. I was just trying to engage them in conversation so we knew what they were, A, doing, and B, to obtain incriminating evidence so then we can obtain legal process, identify who they are, and then arrest them because obviously they're engaged in fraud. It was really eye-opening. And a lot of the people that we learned from when we investigated, arrested, prosecuted these individuals is how they monetize PII, which in my view is really the new coin of the realm in the underground because it's durable. As I said before, you don't get a new social, you don't get a new date of birth. If I steal it for 75 cents or a dollar, or if I buy it for 75 cents or a dollar, I can use it in perpetuity. I could use it this month for tax return fraud. I can use it next month for something else, or I could sit on it. I'm buying it in bulk. So he was selling large amounts of PII for as little as 7 cents a piece. And he's no different than what's going on now. And so you have to have that level of understanding. If you don't even know who your adversary is and what they're trying to do with your information, you're at a disadvantage. And that's part of the problem. And that's why we try to educate whoever we can get, you know, to listen. And sometimes it's really hard because my own family members, right, will just sort of say, hey, that's nice. But, you know, I really want to tell people that I had chicken parm last night. So I'm going to take a picture of it and post it, right? It's that mundane stuff that over time, bad guys will take advantage of.
Because we talked about freezing the credit.
Right.
Does the JIOC put out any, I guess, literature on the subject of cybercrime and fraud?
Well, we don't to the general public because other partners like the FTC have tremendous documentation on their website about how to protect yourself from identity fraud, from other, you know, bad guy stuff. So what we try to do is educate our workforce and our partners, so our investigators, in order to how to combat the fraud as we see new trends develop. Because, you know, there are some areas of the country where some things are really problematic. For example, in Texas and in Florida, fuel pump skimming is a real problem. We push out a lot of intelligence to our local field offices to tell them, hey, the banks believe that there is a suspected fuel pump skimmer at this location. Can you canvass it and let us know if you find any skimmers? And so we've really taken an active approach on that, and we've sent out over 1,000 leads to the field and recovered 300, 400 skimmers so far. We do action weeks during high travel periods to get as much intel on these locations as possible. During the July 4th disruption week, we seized somewhere in the neighborhoods of 70 skimmers off the streets.
Can you go more into the gas pump skimming?
So in fuel pump skimming, what happens is a bad guy will gain physical access to the fuel pump. And they'll gain physical access, open it up, and install a skimmer inside. You, as the person who's going to fill up your gas, will have no idea because it's located inside. So sometimes you'll see people say, well, pull on the outside of the point of sale terminal or pull on this. Or with a fuel pump skimmer, almost without exception now, anybody who is good at it is putting the skimmer inside. They could put it on the crim board. They could put it, connect it inside with ribbon wire. You never know. They're connected to Bluetooth devices, so they don't have to go and retrieve it. And they steal the payment card data. Payment card is payment, credit card, debit card, gift cards. They take that information, and then they use it to buy gift cards and other durable goods that they can sell and monetize it. What we find is these transient organized groups that will travel around the country, buy skimmers from either, you know, a trusted source or someone inside their group will make them. It doesn't take a lot of technological know-how to make them, unfortunately. And so what we do is work with the fuel industry. We work with our other partners from our electronic crimes task forces, financial institutions, to try to get the intelligence on where do we think that they've put them and go and track them down and use forensics to try to identify who the bad guys are. Forensics and, quite frankly, pictures, right? Because there's surveillance cameras. So we're doing our best to try to identify who they are, what vehicles they're driving, where are they going, and then trying to knock down those networks as best we can.
So I'm going to shift gears a little bit here. We've talked about a lot of the business side of what you do. I kind of want to go into a couple of questions about your background.
Sure.
And things like that. I think you're the first individual we've had on that is a legacy agent. You have a family line within the agency, if you will. Your father was a former Secret Service.
Yeah, he sure was. So he came on in Philadelphia in around 1976 and then retired in 99 and then moved on to another federal agency. It was interesting growing up inside the agency because you understand the culture and the demands on the agent a lot better from a child's perspective. I try to keep that in mind in my own life. And hey, what was really important to me as a kid? You know, it might not be every baseball game or whatnot, but it's other things. So you try to keep that into perspective. But also, you become really appreciative of the culture. My dad's friends are friends that he was in on the job with in the 70s. As a matter of fact, my brother married his partner's daughter. It really is a sort of a family atmosphere that makes it a place that you want to be. It's rare where you have an outfit where you might not see somebody for 15 years. But when you see them, it's like you haven't had 15 years of absence. These are longstanding friendships that develop through, you know, traveling, spending nights, weekends, holidays together, working criminal investigations until 3 a.m. on a regular basis, whatever it may be, it develops an esprit de corps that you don't see in a lot of other places.
Do you ever find yourself working day to day and your father's wisdom kind of just crosses your mind about something, or there's one of those days where you're working and you're just like, that's what he meant?
Well, it's interesting because when you talk to folks of his vintage, they will talk about how, hey, you really don't have it that bad, you know, right? Because technology, how you can communicate, how you don't have to go to payphones to make calls. The travel is a lot easier now on phones where you don't have to worry about, you know, did I miss my flight? I don't have any idea. It's 1977 and there's, you know, 8 planes and they all break down. I don't know. I was 2. But whenever I'll make a comment about, hey, well, this, you know, this is a hardship or whatever it is. He'll say, well, you should talk to the guys who were around in the 50s. And in the 50s, they had to work protection at night. They worked counterfeit and all this other stuff. And so it really does bring back a perspective on how lucky we are to have this job and to be part of this culture that is really, you know, positive when it comes to having sort of a family atmosphere. You know, I'm sure I'm just like any other kids whose dads was on the job, you talk about cases, and I will say, and he will say, that the level of case that we work, the sophistication that we deal with, is not something that they dealt with 30 years ago. They were not going after Russian hackers. They were going after guys who were making counterfeit. Now, that was organized crime, but it was local, and it was in your district, and you could use traditional investigative means like CIs and surveillance and stuff like that, where nowadays all of it is technological and it requires a lot more analytical assistance and it requires a lot more time and energy. They were working a lot of stolen check cases, deceased payee cases. You know, deceased payee is somebody dies, they don't tell Social Security or the Treasury, and then they keep collecting. Those kind of cases. A lot of counterfeit. And now, while we still work counterfeit investigations, most of our cases, if you're not working a case that touches some cyber aspect, then you're probably not working a very good case because bad guys are communicating through apps. They're communicating through email, text messages, all those other things require some level of knowledge on how to work these investigations. I will say having that sounding board of somebody who has spent a career, it does provide you a lot of perspective as to, you know, how you should act and comport yourself and deal with challenges that you might have, because almost without exception, everything that you've dealt with, they've dealt with at some time or another.
So as we wrap up, do you have anything for the listeners?
I would tell the listeners to be careful as to what that they provide online, because you don't know who is trying to take advantage of them. And that sounds like an awful thing to say, to think that the world is, you know, always looking at you. But if you operate from that mindset, then you're not going to be surprised later on, and you might defeat what the bad guy's trying to do. They're looking for, as a general rule, low-hanging fruit. So don't be the low-hanging fruit. Close your accounts down, your social media profiles down, freeze your credit, monitor your account statements, and enjoy life.
That's fantastic. Matt, thank you very much for joining us today. I hope to have you back on the podcast to listen to more of your stories and the other things that are going on within the JIOC and the cybercrime community.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you, thank you, thank you for joining us for this episode of Standing Post. I hope you enjoyed it. We want to make sure that every time you press play for the podcast, it was worth your time. Thank you again for all the support, and until next episode, stay vigilant.